Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I am Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Most of the countries in Central Asia have seen only one president since their independence, and those leaders are aging quickly. As a result, the question of succession is becoming a pressing subject. But it's a tricky question because there is no culture of smooth political transition in Central Asia, so the issue of successor emerges as the most important element in the potential political transition of power in the region. Today, in the Majlis, we aim to discuss how Samut is even to become a potential successor. What would a person in this position need to do before and after taking the office? What tricks he or she has to play to become a successor and to remain in power? In this episode of Majlis, a Central Asia podcast, we are intending to discuss this hypothetical but a very realistic question in scenario. To discuss the subject, I have Dr. Julie Fisher-Melton, author of Importing Democracy, Reid Standish, foreign policy columnist specializing in Central Asia, and Adil Baysalov, former chief of the presidential administration on Otunbayeva's presidency in Kyrgyzstan, is joining us via Skype from Bishkek. And Bruce Panier, editor of Central Asia blog, that's called Kishlak Owazi, is joining me in the studio here. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Majlis. Let's start, Reid, with you. Kazakhstan's President Nursultan Nazarbayev might have won a crucial but anticipated victory in recent parliamentary elections, but it does not remove the question of succession. You just published a foreign policy story on this issue, connecting the election outcome with the question of succession. How do these two questions relate to each other, Reid?
Well, I mean, if we look at the elections that happened on Sunday, the parliamentary elections, and the ones that happened a year earlier, the presidential elections, you know, both were a landslide for President Nazarbayev and for his party. So the elections in and of themselves aren't that indicative. If anything, they're maybe just a sign that Nazarbayev isn't quite ready to hand over power just yet. But what we're seeing in the aftermath of this most recent election is sort of this renewed push from the Kazakhs to bring back this rhetoric of talking about devolving powers away from the executive and maybe building up the parliament a little bit, which then, of course, opens the door about, you know, who's going to take over. Is Nazarbayev going to start grooming somebody? And we haven't seen exactly who that person will be yet. Obviously, the decision-making that happens there, it doesn't happen openly. It's all behind closed doors. And according to some people I talk to, you know, the president himself might not even know yet. So it'll be really interesting to see what's going to be happening.
Right. You know, we are intentionally not naming the names today in our discussion, but the idea behind this debate is to talk about the process. Yes, we understand the Kazakh situation. Perhaps the issue of succession might be more urgent in Uzbekistan. If not today, tomorrow, a month later or a year later, people will be faced with the reality of new person in office. What are the scenario for succession in some of those countries and where this question is more urgent than the others? Dr. Julie, you want to jump in there?
I am actually a Latin American specialist, but my most recent book, which was published in 2013, was about democratization NGOs,
right,
civil society, in other words, in South Africa, Tajikistan, and Argentina. Very different countries with the same kind of NGOs doing pretty much the same things, although the challenge is obviously much steeper in Tajikistan than in Argentina or South Africa, despite their problems. So one of the things that I found most interesting and is that despite Tajikistan's authoritarian governmental structure, it was, at least when I did my interview, still possible for these NGOs to have an impact. Some of them work on freedom of the press, for instance, and won court cases on, for instance, helping a television station that was in danger of losing its license. Some of them, but the other thing that a lot of them do is to work at the local level with what, when I was at the Kettering Foundation, and still they call public deliberation. And one of the interesting things about Tajikistan is that the Majlis, which is the name of your program, are also the traditional deliberative organizations at the village level in Tajikistan. And remarkably, many, not all of them, survived the Soviet period And when the NGO movement began in Tajikistan after the transition, those people actually reinvigorated the Majlis. And one of the ways they did it was to say, well, there's one thing wrong with the traditional Majlis. It doesn't include women. So this was one of the major efforts of the intermediary democratization NGOs to begin to include women in the Majlis. And unfortunately, I think from what I read, there has been much more of a crackdown on civil society than there was when we were there doing the interviews some years ago. I think even in 2013, when the book came out, it was still true that that was a much more positive situation than some of the other Central Asian countries. I'd be interested in hearing any of your other guests talk about, you know, what is happening in Tajikistan. One of the people I interviewed remarkably said to me, I've never forgotten this, well, in Tajikistan, we have more freedom than we have democracy. And that enabled some of these organizations to have an impact. So that's my background. It's really only about Tajikistan, but I'd be happy to talk about the more general issue of how you get public deliberation to a higher level. That's really the big challenge.
Right. Dr. Julie, you mentioned that the crackdown in Tajikistan, obviously we are witnessing lots of crackdown recently, even closing down the only Islamic political party in Central Asia.
Right.
So do you see any connection between those crackdown and the question of succession in Tajikistan?
Not really, because the Islamic party has been traditional, is a very small party. It was being harassed when we were there as well. The real question is why there hasn't been any sort of secular opposition party arise, and I would just argue that that's one of the later stages in democratization. Even South Africa doesn't really have a strong, big opposition party, a loyal opposition, if you will. It's probably the last stage. But the fact is that, you know, it's worrisome, but that was happening when we were there, and yet there was also a lot of civil society activity, so I'd be more concerned about crackdowns on civil society than I would on a very small political party.
Right. The elephant of Central Asia, Bruce, Uzbekistan. So what's the best scenario or options for Uzbekistan going forward? This is one of the countries which is faced with this pressing question more than other Central Asian countries.
Without a doubt, and I think Uzbekistan will differ from some of the other countries in that obviously Karimov, like some of the other leaders, Nazarbayev, would like to see a successor who's going to carry on his policies and to some extent preserve Karimov's image, such as it is. I think that a lot of people, probably even inside Uzbekistan, believe that whoever does succeed Karimov will probably dispense with a lot of his policies. Karimov has been a master at juggling not just the various branches of government and the security service, but he's also been able to juggle some of the clan structure, too.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that anyone else has the authority in the country to be able to manage that the way that Karimov has, which leads me to believe that we're going to see a significant departure from the style of rule and the personality of the person, of the individual who becomes president after Karimov leaves the political scene.
Right. Adil, where you are based, Kyrgyzstan, it presents a different picture about the discussion we are having today. But in most of the countries in the region, none of us are expecting that suddenly those countries will shape the entire structure, go for free and fair elections, and elect a new leader. The most probable scenario seems to be an inside arrangement, either ending up with the selection of a member of the presidential family or important figure from the influential power base within the ruling structure. In any case, the question of pre-approved successor plays a huge role in the region. So how does such potential successor emerges within the system in Central Asian scenario?
Well, I think we already saw one transition in Turkmenistan after the death of Turkmenbashi. And of course, it remains still a mystery to most of the outside observers how did the process go and who is Berdimuhamedov. And, you know, this year we will be celebrating 25th anniversary of independence of post-Soviet Central Asia. And I think over the years, when we had all these discussions and who is coming next and who is going to succeed, all these communist apparatchiks and first secretaries, we did have these discussions. As you said, is it a family member or is it a security person or which of the outside forces is going to play a role and etc. But I think currently we need to distinguish each of the five Central Asian republics, because obviously, 25 years after 1991, they absolutely five of them are totally different situations. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about economic development, we can talk about elite maturity, or we can talk about, you know, internal factors, external. But I think what I want to highlight as a growing and very important factor will be the change in the popular expectations of who is the leader. If before our nations wouldn't say anything, for example, if, like, you know, first secretaries are being elected or being appointed or being self-selected, right now this I can clearly see this division between the elites, the old Soviet elites or post-Soviet elites, and the new mass of predominantly young population, who is completely different. For example, currently the most popular person in Kyrgyzstan is one of the preachers, one of the, you know, he calls himself Sheikh, but, you know, you cannot imagine one political or any other personality who is collecting so much audience and whose weekly videos are being watched by hundreds of thousands in Kyrgyzstan. So I think that it is generational change, and our models of succession, which you know, we have like internal security, internal circle type of person, I think we will see one way or another some destabilization, and the chances of person from outside, an outsider coming and taking helms, I think are increasing, and they will be marked by they belonging to the new popular movements, which are probably one way or another will be legitimized by the religion, not by some other credentials, but by the belonging to the Islamic movements.
Oh, that's an interesting point. But that's one thing, Adil. But I'm again coming back to you, not only because of your former position as a political activist. You were in the discussion of similar issues in many times, obviously. So one person to be able to, you know, emerge as a potential successor, right? There are certain other things that person, she or he, has to do, like, for example, where that person has to position herself or himself within the government structure, right? For example, where that person has to be, in which structure that person has to be, or what kind of affiliation that person has to have to be able to be chosen as an obvious choice in a situation like that.
I have a suggestion on that question.
Go on, Dr. Julie.
Yeah, I think, you know, at least in Latin America, many of the most capable local political leaders have emerged as active in civil society first. And if there was some way in which civil society could begin to bring individual government officials into their programs at the local level, so that they get exposed to the sort of bottom-up development and participatory programs, I think it could change thinking of potential leaders long-term. This is a very long-term process. I mean, this isn't going to happen overnight, but I would just make that suggestion because, and I've written about that recently in a blog, which is called Fear of Civil Society, Fear of Civil Society and Zombie NGOs, which is what governments are doing all over the world, creating fake, moribund organizations that sound like they're NGOs. So, and this is a global trend, the repression of civil society. So somehow or other, and I have some, you know, suggestions in this blog. If you go on LinkedIn, it's in my LinkedIn site, Julie Fisher Melton. It has some suggestions for how this repression of civil society, which in the long run, civil society is the hope for institutionalization from below. And without institutionalization from below, you will continue to have change at the top, which really leads to no change at all or a worse situation. So I think the question is not so much who will succeed given the current political culture and political situation in these countries, but how can the political culture be changed from below through institutionalization? And how can you engage individuals in government in that change?
That's a good point. And how much does it relate to Central Asian realities, Edil?
I think, you know, we are discussing, you know, where is the source of this legitimacy? Where is the source of political legitimacy, the successor to be? You know, where does he source it? How does he claim?
Or the power base, for example.
What does he support? But I would like to repeat that each one of the five Central Asian republics is very different. It's very different. We cannot really discuss about general rules. But in response to Dr. Julie's point about civil society, I would like to say that, for example, in Kyrgyzstan, we have civil society, and we have, of course, you know, human rights NGOs, and we have professional associations, and we have these local communities. But one large area of civil society, which are these religious groups and clerics, and which do receive quite a lot of outside support, maybe not from the West, but from the Middle East, they were the ones who succeeded in sourcing all types of legitimacy. You know, they can be nationalistic, they can be anti-imperialist. For example, the recent rhetoric about, like, this anti-Western propaganda, they rode that wave very swiftly and powerfully. So, you know, there is this area of civil society, I mean, of these religious leaders who have the freedom, to organize, to recruit, to spread their message, to act as moral leaders, who in my country, in Kyrgyzstan, have grown exponentially. Like 10 years ago, we wouldn't imagine how much of popular support they would have in the country. But if we discuss, for example, our neighbors, of course, each one of them has a different security situations. Each one of them has a different, you know, issues of popular, you know, support. You know, I think on the scale of
let's talk specifically about Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan case, Edil. Obviously, each country differs from each other in many ways.
Well, you know, we can discuss what is going to happen, and you know, there are two scenarios. Either everything goes according to the plan,
which is
of the big personalities of the current presidents. And they will, in one way or another, ensure smooth transition to a person of the circle, family member or not family member, but of the clan, which provides stability, first of all, to the legacy of the current leaders. Or we will experience some sort of external shock. It can be an external intervention, or it can be some popular uprising. Both of these cases, of course, we'll see different ways. But one thing is what is clear, of course, that we will have a person probably who is going to be grown up and established himself or herself in post-Soviet history. You know, their legitimacy will come, of course, from belonging to the new nations and new national mythology and state that is being built. But I mean, it's very difficult to speculate. We've been speculating about all these scenarios for the last 25 years, but I would like to once again point that we've seeing a great generational change, we're seeing great situational development, and it is time to introduce new models and see some very big underlying currents that probably not quite seen and obvious at the moment, but the situation is very different. How exactly, I don't know, but it is completely different from even what was 5 years ago.
Obviously different. Also, situations are different from country to country, realities are different, and the source of legitimacy or power is different. Bruce, there are rules that clans will play, regions will play, who succeeds any president, any aging president, or in case if someone passes away. But there are also institutions within the government that might play an important role, or the allies that person needs to have to be able to get into this position might play an important role. What are those kind of scenarios in Central Asian situations, especially Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan? That is the highlights of the region that we are talking today.
Well, definitely. I mean, one, you know, as far as the institutions, anyone who's going to succeed to power, clearly they're going to have some powerful allies at the top of the government. I would suggest that in Uzbekistan, it's almost essential that, that a successor have the backing of the National Security Committee, SNB, or they don't have much of a chance of getting in. Past that, of course, there's some clan affiliations. And again, you know, like I said about Karimov, he was a master at balancing, you know, the Samarkand clan, the Tashkent clan, the clans that are in the Fergana Valley. I'm not sure if his successor will have quite such success in balancing the clans, which means they'll probably ultimately be more dependent upon the security network to keep them in power. In Kazakhstan's case, it's a little bit different because we have a much more vibrant economy. Even in these times, you'd have to admit that Kazakhstan has a much bigger, it's more of a money country. So there's going to be a business influence that's going to have to be appealed to at the same time. I would say the security network is probably not so important because it hasn't played such a huge role. It does keep the regime in power, but it's certainly not as visible as the security network is in Uzbekistan. So in Kazakhstan's case, you'd have to have the clan backing. You know, that's the big Jews up there, and you would also have to have the support of business elites to get yourself in. And again, you know, between Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, we do have a little bit of a difference because in Kazakhstan, the royal family, for lack of a better term, is going to have to play some role in the post-Nazarbayev era, at least immediately after that. In Uzbekistan, that's not likely to be the case at all. There was talk years ago that, you know, perhaps the oldest daughter of President Karimov, Gulnara Karimova, might be a successor or have some big role in government. I personally didn't subscribe to that, but in any case, she's certainly lost any hope of doing that with all the recent scandals, financial scandals, and the fact that she's under house arrest. The other daughter's out of the country and shows no interest, and it doesn't seem to show any signs of having any interest in returning to the country. So family won't be playing a big role in Uzbekistan, which leads you back to the inner circle, you know, which is really working independent, at least post Karimov, after he dies, will be more independent of his rule than will be the case in Kazakhstan, where the family will still be somewhere around the top after Nazarbayev goes.
Right, last one.
Is it okay if I jump in there?
Sure. Jump in. I just wanted to come to you. You probably have something to say, but I had a question for you, Right. I mean, what determines a potential successor in this Central Asian scenario? That's another question I want to ask. But yeah, please go ahead with your own opinion first.
Well, this sort of ties into your question, but I think it was a point raised by Bruce that's very interesting, which is if you look at where the elites hold their money, and then that can give us some pretty strong indications about what a possible succession scenario would look like. For instance, when we look at Kazakhstan, if you look at the high-powered elites, the inner circle around Nazarbayev, a lot of those people hold their money overseas, and that's where they generate their income, and they have an interest in Kazakhstan still being part of the world system, international community, especially from an economic and financial standpoint. Access to markets abroad, that's very important for them to keep generating power and to keep making a profit. And if you look at Uzbekistan, a lot more of that wealth and power is generated domestically. So that sort of goes back to, I think, Bruce's interesting point, which is if you look, the security services will probably play a much larger role in Uzbekistan in any succession scenario and could even be the ones who take the reins of power. But if we look at Kazakhstan, it's probably going to be somebody with very strong financial ties, probably with more of an international image. And because of that, they might have an incentive to actually open up the political system more to gain access, to integrate the country more economically into the world.
Great. Thank you very much, Reid, for your thoughts. So let's take a short break here. When we come back, we will be discussing more specifically what role foreign elements might play in scenarios like this and what one has to do after taking office going forward as a new leader of the country. So after the short break, we will continue our discussion. Welcome back to Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Today we are discussing possible scenarios of succession and roadmap for potential successor in Central Asia. I have with me in the studio Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe. Participating from Bishkek via Skype is Edil Vaysalov, who is former chief presidential administration in Otunbayeva's presidency in Kyrgyzstan. Via phone, Dr. Jolie Fisher-Melton, the author of Importing Democracy, is with us from United States. Also from United States, Reid Standish, foreign policy columnist specializing in Central Asia with us via phone. I'm Mohamed Tahir, Director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Majlis. In the first half of the Majlis, we have discussed various scenarios and elements which might play in the selection of potential successors, like where they have to be, what allies they need to have in their relationship with the presidential families, etc. I think in Central Asia, more in some and less in the others, the regional factors also play a huge role in who gets to power, in who remains in the power. So what about the foreign elements or the regional elements? Whenever there is a need for succession, which countries or the regional powers we expect to jump in scenarios like this? Adil, do you want to jump in here?
Yes. Well, you know, I can say on the example of my own country in Kyrgyzstan, of course, we've seen that during the parliamentary elections, it is part of the staple of our electoral campaign is that leading political party leaders, contenders, they will have some formal or informal, of course, but very formal, it is publicly released photos with people in the Kremlin, not necessarily the president, but quite a lot of times prime minister or the head of the Kremlin administration. And then they have some FaceTime with president of Kazakhstan. So it is recognition, international recognition of our most important partners, of course, a huge boost to your legitimacy. I would say, of course, that in all five countries, Russia will make sure that they play a role. And we can see that if we talk about Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, that both of these leaders have been, the whole strategy has been trying to minimize the influence of the outside force, either in toppling them or in dictating who is going to be their successor. But, of course, Russia will be the country. Outside that, I totally agree with Reid, who discussed the international financial and business ties of the Kazakh elites. And, of course, they will try to source some Western or some Chinese support or at least some recognition. But more or less, I think quite publicly, it will be Russian role. They can deny recognition. They can try to interfere. They can try to provide some guarantees against, for example, if there is some security situation or if there's a situation when the instability of the immediate palace events, there is some vacuum of security and, or, you know, they can provide some boost of that security, including, you know, in some indirect ways. The most important source of recognition and support and legitimacy will come from Moscow. We like it or not, but it is the fact of the day.
Can I jump in here? Because I think it's very important, given what we're facing in the Middle East and with the Syrian civil war, to remember that there was a civil war in Tajikistan in the 1990s, a very destructive civil war, not like Syria, but pretty bad. And that was ended because of a civil society dialogue, which included Russia, some individuals in Russia, not the Russian government per se. Primakov was part of it. The Kettering Foundation, where I worked, Hal Saunders was the leader, and several elements of Tajik civil society representing both very general sides in the civil war, the Islamic, more Islamic side and the more secular side. And those dialogues went on for 3 years before the United Nations got involved. And once the United Nations did get involved, they were able to cut and paste huge portions of the agreement that had been reached through this civil society dialogue into the official settlement done by the United Nations and greatly shortened the time needed for the settlement. So I think it's important to not treat what's going on in civil society, either international civil society or local civil society, as some sort of side thing that doesn't have an impact on what happens. It was huge in Tajikistan. And I have an account of this in my book. And I just want to put in one more item about the architect of that dialogue, Hal Saunders, who had been in the State Department and left to join the Kettering Foundation and was the architect of this dialogue. He died only about 2 weeks ago, and I just want to recommend his books, Hal Saunders, on this process for anyone interested in civil society dialogue and its potential impact on a huge problem, not something just at the local level. So I think that's there is also in Washington an organization that he founded called the International Institute for Sustained Dialogue. It's an organization that can work at a community or a national level.
Right.
And there are many other such, what is called often multi-track diplomacy. I have an account in my book of this process, Importing Democracy, the role of NGOs in South Africa, Tajikistan, and Argentina.
Right.
And I think it's one of the most remarkable achievements of civil society that I document in the book.
Civil society is a factor, and Russia, as all of us anticipate, and it has been the case in the past. And Edel, you also mentioned the Chinese factor there, Bruce. That is something I wanted to ask you. I mean, China, whatever happens in Central Asia or going forward, China will have a huge stake, either gain or lose from the changing situation. What role do you anticipate China is playing in scenarios of succession there?
Well, I would kind of flip that a little bit and say that it's more how the Central Asians are going to have to look at, a Central Asian successor is going to have to look at China. No matter who comes to power in any of these other countries, they're going to have to realize that one, their country is deeply in debt to China. Financially, there's just no doubt about it. It's a huge neighbor on their border. It's something, China has never made any really menacing moves towards Central Asia, but it's implicit that China could do some serious damage if it wanted to. But I think more than anything else, especially as we've seen Russia's economy kind of peter out in the last 18 months, 2 years or something like that, the Central Asians have looked more and more to China as a potential financer of their different projects and helping to bail them out if the need arises. So China, just from that point of view, China will always have a role because the Central Asians are dependent. All five of the countries are dependent upon China for money at the end of the day. So China will have some say, but I don't think they have as much to worry about. The Kremlin really wants someone who's pro-Russia. China is just can assume that whoever comes in will have a friendly relationship with China. So it's a little bit different. If I just could add one thing, because I liked what Adil said about Kazakhstan being, you know, considered one of the influential countries on Kyrgyzstan. And of course, we saw that, for instance, when Bakiyev was in, he did not have particularly good relations with Nazarbayev. And I would argue that that's probably one of the reasons he got run out of office, too, is because Kazakhstan had no interest in supporting him, whereas Akayev seemed to get along better with Nazarbayev, and so did. And so has Atambayev for the most part. But if we talk about two different countries in Central Asia, I would say that Tajik succession,
yeah,
Uzbekistan is also going to have some kind of role too. Uzbek-Tajik relations have been horrible from the moment that Rahman was strong enough to resist what Tashkent was telling him to do.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that Karimov or whoever his successor will want to exert the maximum influence on Tajikistan. There's no way they're going to push Russia out. There's no way they'll push the Chinese money out. But they're going to want to force Tajikistan as much as possible to do what Tashkent wants and not solely what Dushanbe wants or what Moscow wants Dushanbe to do.
That's a good point, Uzbekistan. So let's imagine that a person with all these difficulties and challenges, a person gets to the power as a successor of a president. So what that person has to do to be able to remain in power, to gain legitimacy and support of nation or the other actors in the country, what that process looks like in Central Asian scenario, right?
The big issue is, I mean, how you can balance all the other sides around you. You know, if we look at the only other example of succession in Central Asia, it's Turkmenistan. And if you look at that scenario, you know, it was someone who was, you know, relatively seen as underwhelming, and he was chosen because he was something that all the other elites could agree upon. And he's been able to balance all sides and generally keep people happy because of that. So that's sort of one sort of example we can look to for this as a way to hold power, is to balance the elites. The other example, especially if we take in the current poor financial state of the entire region, is what's going to happen, say, you know, 5-10 years or down the road, if, you know, things don't recover in a full way and you don't have the idea of saying we have economic prosperity as a source of legitimacy. You know, one thing like Karimov and Nazarbayev has always had as their benefit is saying, you know, we're the father of this nation. we're the only leader you've ever had. And that in and of itself is always given legitimacy. But the next successor, especially if the economic situation doesn't recover, might have to turn to things like nationalism, populism, maybe religion even is a possibility as a way to try and draw new legitimacy. And that then raises a bunch of other interesting and probably troubling scenarios, especially if we look at Kazakhstan when going back and talking about an idea of Russia. You know, maybe the next president of Kazakhstan decides he wants to use Kazakh nationalism as a way to try and draw up support for his regime. That could then create some very interesting problems with Moscow.
Right. Dr. Julie, you wanted to jump in?
Yes, go ahead. I just wanted to say that I think all of these comments from several people actually assume a sort of idea of elite politics. And that's fine because that's very important, and it's very important to recognize that and begin with that. But I do think that legitimacy long run really can't survive, no matter whether you use nationalism or populism or support of the army or anything else, if you don't begin to engage the public. And I think the comment about economic development was very relevant there. But I think it's deeper than that, and it has to be stronger than that. And the question for me is, are there leaders in Central Asia, maybe in the wings, who understand this, who maybe have emerged from other parts of the economy, not just civil society, but the media, which is part of civil society, really, in a broader sense. Are there people out there, maybe they are elites, but they're not the traditional elites, who are younger, who have emerged from sort of the wider society, and who therefore are willing to reach out to the wider society, be it secular or be it Islamic, in the case of a former comment about the growth of Islamic organizations, in order to build a more stable long-term polity? And I don't think that elite consensus in Central Asia, from what I've read, or elite arrangements have anything more than a very temporary effect on legitimacy. And maybe I will be challenged on that, but I think legitimacy has to be much deeper, or it doesn't work very well, except in the short run.
Obviously. Actually, we have an example of Kyrgyzstan in this case, where it did not work out. Like, the succession wasn't smooth, and then there was lots of troubles and revolutions and all these stuff. Adil, perhaps you might jump in here.
Well, both times, you know, both 2005 and 2010, change of regimes were not planned. They couldn't not be smooth. And, of course, there was initial lack of legitimacy per se. You know, it was one way or another, you know, some violence involved. I think the first true succession of power we will see hopefully next year, next fall, when the current president Atambayev will leave the power after serving one term. According to constitution, he only has 6 years as the president of the country. So the first truly competitive and open field should be next year. And he just last week, he again confirmed that he's going to provide the open field. He's not going to handpick a successor, and he's going to respect the will of the people. We can go on and on discussing what went wrong or what went what didn't go. But I think, I see a real divide between what goes on in Bishkek and downtown Bishkek among the old elites who were educated and brought up during the Soviet era, you know, and there is some inertia on the top. There is some inertia among us. We continue see and analyze, applying some models which are, I think, outdated. I think we entered the completely new phase of our development, and I can speak about my own country for sure, that we'll probably see a much, the current state is, you know, is going to grow weaker, and the new movements which will emerge will be completely different, and they will not be part of what we have right now.
Right. Unfortunately, we have to wrap up the discussion. Final comments, Bruce Panier. Assuming a person comes to power, holds the office, what's the best scenario that person can balance the interests of various stakeholders and remain in power.
Well, there's, I mean, the ultimate scenario, I would agree with Dr. Julie 100% that it would be great if they had a civil society and the people enjoyed actual popular support. Now, Reid made a very important point there earlier with, if we look at all the countries except for, with the exclusion of Kyrgyzstan, we're basically dealing with long-term leaders who would have to be replaced, and in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan is placed by, you know, the only leader they've ever known, and just to a large extent, Tajikistan, who Rahman's been in for well over 20 years now. They're going to be replaced by someone that people don't know very well. So they're going to have to find some, they're not going to be popular by the, just by virtue of the fact that they have come from the government structure, they will not be popular, and they're going to have to find something to get some sort of support from the people. And I've always, it's always been my greatest concern that we're going to look at them playing the nationalist card, which Reid also mentioned. I would agree with that, that I think that's the easiest way to get support from your people. The unfortunate thing is the populations of all these Central Asian countries are mixed. And the minute you start saying ethnic Kazakh, Uzbek, Tajik, whatever above the other ones, you put yourself in a real hard situation in terms of your own society, because there's a lot of people that potentially could be targeted under such policies.
Right, right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Bruce Panier, for your insightful comments. From Bishkek, Edelbay Salov, former chief of presidential administration in Tombayba's presidency, thank you very much for being in the show, Edel. Also, big thanks goes to Dr. Julie Fisher-Milton, the author of Importing Democracy, and Reid Standish, foreign policy columnist specializing in Central Asia. Welcome, guests, for being in the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And this
Thank
is it
you.
From me, Mohammed Tahir, director of the Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Bye-bye.